Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
With 6 months left in this legislative session, we're touching base with state leaders about some of the key issues on their agendas. Today, we're joined by Senate President Stan Rosenberg. Thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, very nice to have you. We're going to first tell listeners that if they have a question for you, they can call in and ask as well. So, listeners, what would you like the legislature to focus on this year? What issues matter to you? And what would you like to ask Senate President Stan Rosenberg? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Senate President Rosenberg, first I'd like to know, in the remaining months of this legislative session, what do you want to focus on most, if you could pick one or two issues?
So, well, every year the biggest piece of legislation is the budget, and I'm sure we'll talk about more about that later, but budget is number one. Number two would be opioid legislation. Number three would be energy legislation. Mm-hmm. And there might still be some additional work that we could do that relates to income inequality here in Massachusetts. As you know, last year we did the first increase in the earned income tax credit in 18 years. And as you also remember, just 2 weeks ago, the second installment of an increase in the minimum wage went into effect. So about 450 to 500,000 families saw some real relief that helps with the income inequality problem. But there's more to be done, and maybe we can find some things that we can do in the remainder of this term on that front as well.
Now, we heard from the governor at the start of this year and from the Mass Taxpayers Foundation that there might be some serious budget issues and some cutting that's going to have to be done. And Governor Baker said that he might have to take a surgical approach to things and sort of look very carefully at every individual funding appropriation and decide what's going to happen. Do you predict that there's going to be a tough year ahead?
Yeah, there will be. The good news is last year's structural deficit was at $1.8 billion, and this year they're talking about something closer to $1 billion. A lot of this comes as a result of the fact that there are no new revenues on the table, and costs continue to escalate. So it's not that we're building a lot of new programs. It's just that things like health care and local aid and things of that nature, basically the costs grow. And so the revenue isn't keeping up with the growth in the spending side. So that means you have to make efficiencies, you have to do some cutting, things of that nature.
Right. So any ideas at this point as to where you think you're going to...
It's too early. The governor will release his budget, I think, late this week. And the House will next start reviewing the budget. And both the House and Senate Ways and Means Committees will do hearings across the Commonwealth. The House will debate their budget usually in April, the Senate in May. The differences will be worked out in the month of June, and hopefully the budget will be on the governor's desk by July 1st or within a few days after.
Let's talk about what unfortunately has become the brunt of a lot of jokes, the MBTA and funding there. And there is now a fiscal control board in charge. But we're also hearing about the salaries and pensions, which has probably been debated for as long as you've been in the Senate, right? What do we do about these? How do we reduce costs? What's going to happen? I believe the Globe just last month published a lot of the financial information that's come out about the MBTA. Is that something that you think lawmakers are going to address at this point because of what's happening with the MBTA?
So all of that's in the hands of the control board at this point, and we've given them some pretty significant powers. And a lot of what you're reading are sort of the exceptions to the rule. That said,
you mean in terms of the salaries?
Yes.
And the pensions.
So first, they should be looking at all of those exceptions and making sure that absurd things don't continue to happen. And then you have to look at the base expenditures as well. Our system is more expensive than most other, if not all other, urban subway systems in the country. There's a couple of things going on. First, it's the oldest continuously operating system in the country, so it's very, very old infrastructure. There's also some business practices, if you will, at the T that are not in line with typical best practices around the country. And that's something that the Fiscal Control Board is looking at to try to determine where we're out of line, why we're out of line, And if we're out of line for good reason, then they have to explain it. If we're not out of line for good reason, then we have to fix it.
I want to talk about something that you didn't mention as one of the things that you would like to achieve this legislative session. And I will talk about some of the things you did mention. But first, what about charter schools? Because I believe you've said that you expect to make a decision sometime very soon about whether legislation will go forward about lifting the cap on charters. Mm-hmm. Obviously, hugely controversial issue. Governor Baker has proposed legislation. There may be a ballot question. What's going on with that?
So last term, the House of Representatives passed a bill. The Senate took up a bill that was similar but not identical and defeated it overwhelmingly. As people said, it's been 20 years. We haven't reviewed and revised the program, and we're not willing to lift the cap without considering the things that are not going as well as they should. So I undertook three separate caucuses in the Senate so the members could hear from opponents, then another caucus on proponents, and then the third caucus was our own discussion. And then I spent the holidays talking with each of the Democratic senators. The minority leader did so with the minority caucus. And so within the next couple of weeks, within this next couple of weeks, we'll have a decision whether we're going to move forward or not with trying to actually construct a bill and send it over to the House.
Mm-hmm. So you're still in the process of deciding.
Yeah, what we have, we know it's going to be a tough sell in the Senate if we try to undertake it. We want to make sure that we can have a reasonable and potentially successful debate. We don't want to, you know, tilt at windmills here. If we think we can actually pass a reasonable bill combining reforms with some lifting of the cap, then it's worth undertaking. If we think it's just going to be a fool's errand or we'll be tilting at windmills, then there's no sense taking up the time of the body doing that. So, but we're taking it all very, very seriously, and we will make a decision very soon.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it might go on the ballot.
Otherwise, and by the way, we could pass a bill in the Senate. It could still stay on the ballot because mm-hmm. if the proponents are not happy with a bill passed in the legislature, then they would collect the additional signatures, and it could be on the ballot. And we would then have a new law and have this on the ballot as well. I suspect it won't happen quite that way because if the proponents are not satisfied, I'm going to assume that the governor won't be satisfied, and therefore we wouldn't have a new law, but we would have a ballot debate instead.
Okay, I want to go to the phones because we have several folks waiting to ask you questions. The first is Lori, who is calling from Worcester. Lori, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Senator. I am curious as to what your position is regarding the open meeting law at state legislative level. All our municipalities are required to have open meetings and meetings at which people can attend and reporters can attend and notes can be taken. I'm concerned that that's not true at the state level, and I was wondering what you are planning to do to address that. I'm going to take your answer off the phone so I can hear it on the radio. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for your call and question. So now hopefully you're off the phone and can hear the answer. So the answer is in the legislature, all legislation that is filed has a public hearing. The public hearings are open to the public. We often will record and broadcast those hearings. And all of the testimony that's submitted is available to the public. The common practice in legislatures in America is that they have minority caucuses and majority caucuses, and those are opportunities for the members of the caucus to debate freely, share ideas, think out of the box, think off the top of their head, and not posture for the public. And so those particular types of meetings are meetings that are private in the sense that they're anybody in the room can hear everything that's said, and believe me, much of what's said in the room is often repeated outside of the room, but at least the members have the opportunity to share ideas without fear of being, you know, misquoted or misrepresented as a result of saying something off the top of their head, which isn't their official position, et cetera. And so it is in the nature of legislative bodies to provide that opportunity. But then we go into the chamber and we have a debate on the floor, and then votes are taken, often recorded votes, sometimes not recorded votes. And increasingly, And by the way, those sessions are live streamed, so people can actually see them.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but it sounds so staged then at this point, isn't it?
No, not staged. And in fact, there was a period of time when I think it might have been it might actually have been a fair criticism that debates in the Senate might have been staged. They're not staged. They are the discussion that happens in the caucus is exploratory, and you know, putting ideas out there, explaining what you're thinking, explaining the background, et cetera. But much of what's said in the caucus is then actually repeated on the floor. And if you look at the Senate debates as we've been conducting them in this term, you'll see that that there are much more robust debates on the floor. And again, there have been periods of time when it almost felt like it was scripted, but I don't think that would be a fair assessment of what's happening in the Senate these days.
But public records reform is certainly an issue that has come up before lawmakers.
Absolutely. And the House passed a version. The Senate is scheduled to take it up on February 3rd. It's the first modernization of the statute in 40 years. We're way behind the rest of the country in making public records accessible to the public. And we're just behind the times. We have to modernize it. And there's no point in having a public records law if people can't get it in a timely fashion at a reasonable cost, if there's any cost at all.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that will go something similar to what the House has already taken up will go forward in the Senate?
There's four members of the Senate who are bird-dogging this issue. They've been meeting, and they're going to put out a draft in about a week, week and a half, and I expect it'll be a meaningful piece of legislation, and I hope that the public will consider it a worthy effort.
Okay. I want to remind listeners that if you'd like to ask Senate President Stan Rosenberg a question, you can give us a call. What would you like the legislature to focus on this year? Our number is 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. John is calling from Cambridge. John, you're on the air.
Thank you, Senator, for taking the question. My question is, if you have a view on the $15 minimum wage for workers at Logan. I'm asking because I do fly in and out of Logan all the time, and perhaps as evidenced by the Russian airliner in Sinai, I believe that unhappy, underpaid airport workers do pose a security risk.
I'm in favor of increasing wages for all low-wage workers. I'm in favor of something that we tend to call a living wage. A lot of people debate what that actually means, but in the Boston area, you have to be in the low 20s in order to be able to support your family on a 40-hour or even 60-hour a week job or collection of jobs. So one of our major focuses in the Senate is income inequality. We are very mindful of the fact that from the late 70s to where we are today, the standard of living for people in the lower half of the economy has stagnated and is dropping. In the next quartile or quintile, they're barely holding their own. So if you're in the bottom 80%, you're struggling and you're worried about your job, your family's future. And even if you go from 80 to 90%, you're still not, feeling as comfortable as you might have felt in the 1970s and 80s as all boats were rising and a growing share of, a fair share of the growth in the economy was being shared by all people in the economy. And the differential between the highest earners and the lowest earners was about 34 to 1. As opposed to the current 350 to 400 to 1. So I'm very much in favor of continuing along the path of making sure that people have wages and compensation packages, including their benefits, which will allow them to support themselves and their families.
Speaking of which, let's talk about a hearing that's taking place today before the Revenue Committee regarding the so-called millionaire tax. This plan would establish a 4% surtax on incomes over $1 million. Do you support that?
Absolutely.
Why?
Again, it goes back to the income inequality situation. Essentially, we're one of only a handful of states that has an income tax that under our Constitution prohibits us from having a graduated system. Our federal tax, income tax is graduated, and something around two-thirds or three-quarters of all the states that have an income tax, it's graduated. In Massachusetts, it has to be a flat tax, and that just means that the people who are earning extremely high wages are basically paying the same 5.1% as the people at the lower end of the scale.
But the argument, of course, is those folks making extremely high wages will move out of state. Maybe New Hampshire, maybe Rhode Island, and Massachusetts loses out completely.
The data that we've seen indicates that people don't do that. The quality of life here in Massachusetts, number one, and number two, a lot of the places that you'd want to move to, their tax systems catch you in other ways. So you go to New Hampshire, and it's all about the property tax. You go to Florida, it's all about the sales tax. So basically, it's not something that the economists, 71 economists issued a report just in the last 24 hours indicating that they've studied this very question and that we would not be placing ourselves at a competitive disadvantage. A few people, we would have a little bit of leakage, but it would not be significant because most of the people who are earning those high wages are actually living and working here in a job where they're collecting those dollars, and if they leave the state, they're not going to be collecting those dollars in other states. We have the third highest per capita income in the country.
All right, I want to go to callers because we have lots of them.
Terrific.
They all want to talk to you. Betsy is calling from Brewster. Betsy, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am concerned about Entergy. You talked about tilting at windmills. I am worrying about tilting at Pilgrim. My wonderful state senator, Dan Wolf, has proposed two bills, Senate Bill 1797 and Senate Bill 798, that will hold Entergy accountable for paying for the expenses for decommissioning so that the citizens of the Commonwealth, all across the Commonwealth, don't have to pay for making taking those steps. I have a cousin who lives in Vermont, and when I told her about Dan's bill and mentioned Entergy, she just laughed and said, good luck. So I'm counting on you to bring us more than good luck, to bring us good legislation.
Well, thank you. And Dan has been in touch with me on both of these bills. I actually, in my freshman year as a state senator, went through the same thing as plant in Roe, which is not in the Senate district I represent, but on the edge, had just announced that they got their 20-year extension, and within a year they found out that the plant was in such bad shape that they closed it and never reopened it. And so I've lived through the decommissioning process. I also, because Vermont Yankee is on the border of my district, because I represent Coleraine, which is the town just south of the Vermont border, we've been following and going through that as well. So I don't know the details. Each one is different. Each of these plants' details is different. But I've been through the pattern of closing, and I will work to ensure that the decommissioning process goes well and that the company fulfills its responsibilities under both federal and state laws. Most of them are federal laws, of course, but we'll definitely work to hold them accountable to safely closing that plant.
The numbers that we have, at least initial numbers that we have, is requiring Entergy to spend some $58 million a year.
It's very expensive to do it. They were supposed to be saving money, and they should have inherited that when they bought the plant from whoever they bought the plant from. Again, this is because I don't know the detail, but I can just tell you that they have a responsibility to close it properly. We have to keep the pressure on the federal, let's see, it's a federal agency, the nuclear agency.
Nuclear Regulatory?
Yes.
Okay.
Nuclear Regulatory Agency. I was trying to think of the acronym.
You don't want to say NRA.
We have to get them, we have to keep on them so that they keep onto energy to do their job properly.
Let's talk opioids, because you mentioned it as one of the things that you want. And I just want to make sure that we have this clear, because we know that the House has come out with its version of the bill, which is different from what was approved by the Senate. And there is no longer that provision that the governor had suggested, requiring that someone be involuntarily held for 72 hours if they are in an emergency room after an overdose. And this is very controversial. And, of course, this is one of the sticking points. Do you think that the Senate legislation might change?
That's off the table, because it was not in the Senate version of the bill. And the House put in a provision. I don't know the fine detail of it, but roughly it's a 24-hour evaluation. That makes a lot more sense to me than a 72-hour involuntary hold. That said, I'm going to reserve the judgment for the six conferees to drill down and make a recommendation back to the Senate, because we've not debated that issue.
Okay. So at this point, it's unclear as to where this legislation
where
went, or
that
what
particular provision. But the good news is the governor, the Senate, and the House are all in the same direction now. For the first year, we focused on treatment. With these bills that the governor filed, the House and the Senate, it focuses on training and prevention. And so we're all heading in the same direction now. I hope that it'll be a relatively quick conference, because a lot hangs in the balance in terms of helping people who need help.
All right. Senate President Stan Rosenberg, we have a couple of minutes left, so I want to make sure we get at least one or two more calls in. Roger is calling from Lexington. Roger, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to know if Rep. Rosenberg has an update on the important gun safety law that was passed in 2014 in terms of the implementation of a portal for private sales, as well as reporting requirements for the police districts within Massachusetts?
I do not have an update. My understanding is it's been going well. If you need a clearer answer, Senator Timmelty is the chair of the Committee of Jurisdiction, and Senator Cream was very active on that as well. So I think those two senators' offices could probably give you some insight.
Okay, great. I want to ask you about also, I'm trying to get as much in as possible in the few minutes we have. So
lightning round. Let's do
the lightning round if we can. UMass funding. There's
yes.
a big brouhaha over that. And apparently there's still some discussion about what might happen next. What happened with the funding for UMass?
So let's look forward rather than back. Okay. Usually collective bargaining agreements are funded through a supplemental budget. It did not occur last year. As we head into the next budget cycle, we need to take another run at it and see if we can find some way of managing this through the fiscal 17 budget. It is challenging, again, because of the fiscal situation, as we discussed at the very top of our conversation.
I want to ask you about your fiancé, Brian Hefner. Last month he was in the news when he said he was considering running for Senate. He has decided not to run, and you have told lawmakers that you've had to erect a firewall, right, between your personal and professional life. Is it challenging to do that? Is it difficult for you to do that?
Like all other couples, we talk about things that happen during the day, in the evening. And the important thing is that when I made that statement, it was because there was some understanding or interpretation that he was going to be interfering in the day-to-day work of the Senate. And that's what I meant when I said there's no firewall. He is not participating in any decisions. He doesn't participate in anything that would be inappropriate. And it doesn't go beyond anything that any couple would engage in talking about their day and their jobs.
And lastly, I just want to end on this, apparently, that we have to end, unfortunately. You were in foster care at one point in your life. And I'm just wondering how that shapes your perspective overall, and particularly how it shapes your perspective and has in this past year when we've had all these crises in the Department of Children and Families.
So when I came into the legislature in my freshman year, Representative Parenti came up to me on the floor one day and she said, "Do you realize that there are four former foster kids in the Massachusetts House of Representatives? Four out of 160, when you think about that, it's pretty remarkable, because the general view is that foster care is a path to nowhere. And the fact that people do succeed going through the foster care, after they've gone through the foster care system, was something that she wanted and encouraged us to focus on so we could be examples to kids who are in foster care or in adoption tracks. And so the bottom line for us is that as a result of that, we have spent the last 25 years trying to help improve the foster care system here in Massachusetts. Many positive changes have been made, but it is an extremely challenging agency to run, to work in, to be served by, because there are just so many challenges with trying to maintain a quality system when you have uneven funding, when you have uneven caseloads, when you have changing policy. And I think we're headed in a new direction here. The governor has drilled down deeply and has focused on where he thinks we can improve management, policy, and staffing and holding people accountable, all of which he believes will lead to a better, more stable system.
All right. Senate President Stan Rosenberg, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Yeah, very quick. Tune in next week. We'll hear from House Speaker Robert DeLeo. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.